getting lumped up with Rocker Mike and Rob Rossi. I'm getting lumped up with Rocker Mike and Rob Rossi. Well, I'm lumped up, but I'm okay. It's gonna get lumped up anyway. You better call back the posse. Just getting lumped up with Rocker Mike and Rob Rossi. Getting lumped up with Rocker Mike and Rob Rossi.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to an episode of Rocker Mike and Rob Presents. I'm Rocker Mike. We got Rob Rossi top left. This is episode 107, people. We are moving along really good. We have a very special show today. I'm really excited and we're honored to have on Don Daneman from the 60s pop band The Circle. How you doing, Don?
I'm great. Good to be here. Thank you.
Glad you're here. The Circle is known for probably their most famous song is Red Rubber Ball, a song that you still hear on the radio and other places today. They have a brand new album out. It's their first in over 50 years. It's on Big Stir Records. It's called Revival, and it's going to be released on March 22nd. Is that correct?
Yep, that's what I heard. Yeah.
Okay, so that before we get into it, where will we be able to get that?
I think you can get it on any standard place that people buy records.
Amazon?
Or stream, any place, yeah.
Okay,
excellent. Excellent.
Okay, now we're going to get into a little bit of the history of The Circle, which is really fascinating, people, because there's a great Beatles connection, there's a great Paul Simon connection. They really have, you know, they were in the center of this great era of music, and they had big hits, okay, two major hits at the time. Originally, you guys are from Easton, Pennsylvania, right?
Lafayette College. We are from there. We went to college there.
Okay. Yeah. I'm actually very familiar with Easton itself. I've been involved with some of the oldie shows at the theater there.
The State Theater?
State Theater, yes.
Big theater in town, yeah.
Right. Yeah. Now, you guys started out as the Rondells, is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay. Give us a little story. How did you start playing music? How did the Rondells form? And then how did it turn into The Circle?
Okay. So, freshman year, 1961, Lafayette College. I come to college with my guitar in hand, and I'm there in my room at the fraternity, not at the fraternity house. You had no contact with fraternities first semester, sorry. At a freshman mixer,
right.
a band that was hired to play at this freshman mixer took a break. And during the break, a couple of guys picked up instruments and started playing. And that is actually the first verse of a song that when we talk about the album, I'll make that connection.
Right.
Anyway. A new friend of mine said, hey, you play guitar. You should go play with them. Anyway, we lugged my amp down. We lugged my guitar down. Hey, can I play? Yeah, let's play. We had a magic moment of we knew the same songs. It was like Everly Brothers, Buddy Holly, doo-wop songs of the time. This is 1961.
Sure.
And it was like, hey, let's start a band. And so we got together and we did some practicing. But I told the guys I didn't really want to be in a band. As much as I loved the concept of doing it, I didn't want to be in a band because I had a girlfriend who was still in high school back home. And I wanted to have her up as a, you know, not watching the band play on party weekends. So, but we said, well, let's practice anyway. And we practiced and we did well in our practices. At Christmas vacation, my girlfriend announced she had a new boyfriend.
Ah.
And that was the end of that. And I was heartbroken.
Yeah.
But when I came back after Christmas vacation, I told the guys, you know what? I'm broken up. I have no girlfriend. If you want to do the band, do it. So we actually started the band. And Tommy Dawes, sadly deceased bandmate now,
yes.
He just came up to me one day, says, hey, Don, our name is going to be the Rondells. And it sounded like a typical 50s name. And I had nothing better to. So I said, sure, we're the Rondells.
Good name.
Yeah, and it was a good name. And we began to play. And funnily enough, our first job was actually not at Lafayette. It was at Lehigh down the road. You know, it's like somebody knew somebody. And our first job was at a fraternity party at Lehigh.
Gotcha.
Anyway, well, now if you it, as I talk, because I know the history real well, and I can go not you guys can go to sleep, and I can tell the whole thing.
Oh.
But if you want to stop me to you know, hey, no, but what about this? Please feel
you,
free.
You absolutely have the floor here, Don. Don't worry.
Yes, you do.
Okay. All right. So in 1964, at Spring Interfraternity Weekend, we bought long-haired wigs and we put on a Beatles show. And this Beatles show was so successful that Warren Covington, the leader of the Tommy Dorsey Orchestra, which was the other band at Interfraternity Weekend, it was like a regular band and a rock band. We were the rock band. He brought us to Atlantic City to see if maybe we could do something together. Never quite worked out to do anything together. His thing and our thing didn't quite jive. But there we were in Atlantic City, and we thought, let's get a job. Let's get a summer job. And we ended up at the Alibi Bar, South Carolina Avenue, off the boardwalk in Atlantic City.
Yes.
And we played there for 2 summers. At the end of the second summer, everybody's going their separate ways. A guy walks in, and he hears us, and he comes up to me, introduces himself. My name is Nat Weiss. I'm a matrimonial lawyer, but I'm a good friend of Beatle manager Brian Epstein, and I think you guys are great. Maybe we can do something. So we thought, no way. You know, are you kidding me? So anyway, we left. You know, we all went our separate ways. Earl, keyboard player, original keyboard player, he's back at University of Chicago Med School. Tommy and Marty are back at Lafayette. Tommy had 6 months or had a semester, and Marty still had to finish the year. I am now living in East Chester with my parents, which is a suburb of New York.
Yes.
And working in the sheet metal factory. My dad had a small sheet metal manufacturing company. And I thought, you know, I had this guy's card. Let me give him a call. So I call him up and, oh, yeah, Don, how are you? You know, he immediately
remembered you.
I was very pleasantly surprised. Yeah, he immediately remembered me. And he said he gave me a time and a date and an address. Come down to the city. And it was an easy ride. Suburban New York is, you know, East Chester. I'll introduce you to Brian. Okay, I took a buddy of mine. We drove down, and it was a side street on the Upper East Side. And we went in. It was a floor up. We went up. There was a party. Matt wasn't there. We're standing around. We're both kind of shy.
Right.
And anyway, a little time goes by. Nat walks in. I go up to him. Nat, hi. You know, oh, Don, yeah. He shakes my hand. Follow me. I follow him down. And son of a gun, there's a limo right outside on the street. And that, and I love that we're on video. I know all your listeners won't see the video, but for those who do, Nat graciously beckoned me as he opened the door to the limo. He beckoned me in. And I follow him in, and he sits me down, and son of a gun, I am sitting directly in front of Beatle manager Brian Epstein.
Wow.
I mean, mind-blowing.
Sure.
So
had to be.
And, of course, we are huge Beatles fans. We knew everything about them, you know, that you could imagine. So now Nat introduces me, and I have to take one step back before I tell you the introduction, because if I don't, it's going to sound like I'm really a snooty bragger. So the way I think of myself in terms of my talent level is I think I have a pretty good light rock voice. And when used correctly, it, obviously it was Red Rubber Ball voice. I mean, you know, it can, it's pretty good.
Yes.
Okay.
I'd agree.
I'm a decent guitar player. I'm not Eric Clapton or Eddie Van Halen, but I'm a decent guitar player. Okay.
Right.
Now, Nat now introduces me. And I mean, and I, this is like a videotape in my head. I guess Brian Epstein, I'd like you to meet Don Daneman, one of the finest musicians I know.
Oh, boy.
That's why I had to go back and tell you. So that's how he introduced me.
Yeah.
All right. So now I had a few exchanges with him. And Brian, in all of the interactions we had with him, he is a gentleman. He was a really very sweet, mild-mannered gentleman.
Right.
And it was kind of, and it was kind of along the lines of, like, you know, oh, Brian, wow, it's so great to meet you. You know, Nat told me that he was partners with you. Oh, yes, Don. Yes, Nat has told me about you, and he has spoken very highly of you.
Right.
And yes, perhaps stay in touch. Perhaps we can make something happen here. Yes, we are starting a management company here in the U.S. Okay, so anyway, a little bit back and forth. Now, as gracious as Nat beckoned me in, he now opened the door and beckoned me out.
Right.
All right. So I'm now standing on the street. The limo, I have this also. It's a picture of a video in my head. The limo slowly pulls off. It's a side street. There's no traffic. It pulls off into black, fade out.
Wow.
So obviously, this was a major moment, you know.
Sure.
All right. So I call Tommy and Marty at Lafayette, and I tell them what happened. And this got us to set up a makeshift recording studio in my basement in Eastchester. And we recorded several demos, and they were pretty decent. I mean, they were really pretty decent. And I set up with Nat to play them for him because we said, let's do something. We got to get, let's, maybe we can really get him excited and get something happening. So I had an appointment to go into Nat's apartment in the city and play him these demos. And funnily enough, the night of the appointment, some of your listeners may remember this, November 11, 1965.
The blackout?
Yes.
Yeah.
Got it. It was the day of the whole East Coast blacked out. We thought the Russians are coming.
Right.
Obviously, I didn't have the appointment then, but I did, you know, we scheduled it a little later. And so anyway, I go up to his apartment, lugging my tape recorder up. I'm about to wire it in, and I brought a pair of stereo headphones with me. Now, stereo headphones are just a very common, everybody has headphones nowadays. In 1965,
that was a big thing.
Oh, nobody had. Yeah, that was a big thing. I said, wow. Nat, here, why don't you listen to this? And I saw him. I think we had two things going for us. One is, the demos really were pretty good. And the other is he's hearing stereo headphones for the first time. So I, as I hit play and I saw the music start, and his eyes kind of lit up. He looked up at the ceiling and I thought, ah, I think he likes it. I think we're good. So that got him to keep the ball rolling. And he got us to play in the city. And at that time, it was still just Tom, Marty, and I. Earl is often still in medical school.
Right.
And this got us, so it got us auditions for record companies, and Columbia Records picked us up with a new young producer, John Simon, who became our producer and has gone on to do some pretty big things.
Yes.
So we had that. Tommy met a guy named Barry Kornfeld that he became friendly with, had a publishing company with Paul Simon. And we heard Red Rubber Ball as we're looking for things to record. We heard Red Rubber Ball on a scratchy 45 record, just Paul Simon and a guitar singing Red Rubber Ball. And we thought, okay, let's give it a shot, you know? So that was one of several songs we recorded. And I still remember now the recording session at Columbia Studios now, recording Red Rubber Ball. And I'll share with you about it. One is we're recording it over and over and over again. We finally had a take that sounded like, I think this is the take. It really sounded good. And we're coming right to the end. And I'm playing and we're all playing. The guitar part, that it goes through the song, as you know, in the breaks, it's da 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 da. Okay, the guitar part, there's one note right at the end after the vocal and the thing is going out, I actually missed. Oh. And we all went, oh God, you know, like that. And a lot of discussion back and forth, but we realized, you know what? It sounds like I did it on purpose.
Okay.
I mean, a lead guitar player wouldn't necessarily play exactly the thing. And if you listen to the record now, the final record, there's a note. I forget exactly where it comes. I mean, when you hear it, it's there. And obviously, it didn't take away from the hit.
You know, what's funny is there's a lot of albums, or I should say singles, like that, that there's a little mistake in there that they kept in. Like Louie Louie has that famous in the middle where he comes in too soon singing.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Repeats it.
Yeah.
And, you know, it just worked. So you know, you just leave it in.
Yeah. Some mistakes just work.
That's true.
All right. So now we had Red Rubber Ball. Now let me just think. So
you knew this was a Paul Simon composition?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Paul Simon and Bruce Woodley of the Seekers.
Of the Seekers. Right. Right.
Wrote that.
I'm sure you were big Simon and Garfunkel fans at that point.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we were. Yeah. And okay. It was cool to meet him. And, you know, that was kind of neat, too. So let me just think. So now the next thing is, all right, so we had our management contract with Nat and Brian. We had a Columbia record contract, John Simon producer. We were still the Rondells.
I was going to ask you, when did the change to the Circle kick in?
Okay, now this was in that time period, the early recording with Columbia. Brian came into the studio while we were recording one day, and he hands me his business card. And I look at it. I see it. It looks like a regular business card. It says Brian Epstein on it. No, Don. Turn it over, says Brian. Okay, I turn it over. And I see scribbling on the back of the card. And I can't really read it. I mean, it's scribbling. I see a C there. And Brian, what am I reading? Oh, Don, that's your new name. And notice it's The Circle with the funny spelling. C-Y-R-K-L-E. And who would have thought of that? It was John, of course. Mm-hmm. That when I was back in England, I asked the boys, as right. they lovingly referred to them, I asked the boys, "Do you anybody have an idea for our name for our new American group?" And it was John, of course, that came up with Circle, C-Y-R-K-L-E. So the really cool thing about that little part of the story is, I had in my hand a card with Brian Epstein's business card with John Lennon having written the circle on the back. And we got, so John Lennon, ladies and gentlemen, yep. John Lennon gave us our name.
Now, let me ask you this, Don. Now, yeah. I don't know if it's true, and I'm sure you could verify it right now. Did it have anything to do with the famous traffic circle in Easton, Pennsylvania?
We have gotten people asking that. No.
Okay.
There is actually no relation to anything that we have ever done or talked about or anything.
So that's just a myth.
That relates to the traffic circle in Easton. Now, there is a traffic circle.
Oh, yeah. I know it well because there's a couple of great restaurants right there.
Oh, okay.
In the circle. And I've walked through it many times.
Oh, all right. Anyway, so the sad thing about that part of the story is, though, that I was never good at keeping that sort of stuff. And that card was in the trash the next day. And I'm so bummed about that. I mean, how neat would that be to have up on the wall?
That's like that? Yeah. That yeah. was invaluable. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. So that went. Okay. Now, So I'm going to keep going. Now, once again, if you want to go in a different direction, you just tell me.
No, you got it.
Good.
Okay. Now, all right. So we record Red Rubber Ball. We did we did more gigs at clubs in the city.
Right.
And now I am now off into the Coast Guard Reserve in February of 66.
Were you drafted?
No, that's no. Why I was in the Coast Guard Reserve.
You was volunteer, right?
Yeah. Not be drafted. Yeah, I volunteered. I was in. It was a 6-month active duty stint.
Right.
All right. So while in the Coast Guard Reserve, I got a call from Nat, who said, "Hey, Don, we have an opportunity to be on Hullabaloo," which, for those of you who remember, it was a big music TV show at the time.
Right.
And we have an opportunity to be on Hullabaloo. And if you could get like maybe a pass, you know, we can present Red Rubber Ball. Mm-hmm. Anyway, the Coast Guard they were really nice. They actually gave me a 3-day pass.
Gave you a pass.
They gave me a pass. And this was one of the most surreal moments also in my life, this episode, because I got on a bus from Cape May, New Jersey, went up to New York. It was in Brooklyn where this show was taped.
Yeah, it was filmed in Brooklyn, right?
Yeah, in Brooklyn. And so we did the show. Paul Anka was the host. Leslie Gore was on it, and Peter and Gordon. And they were all really nice. I mean, everybody was very cordial, you know, "Oh, congratulations, you got a new record out." You know, they were really nice. There's an interesting connection with Peter Asher, because Peter Asher has been and is on, we're about to go on the Flower Power cruise, and Peter is on it. And last time we were on it, he introduced us. And he introduced us with a major deal about something that we all knew, but I never thought about it in that context. He introduced us as, "Ladies and gentlemen, you know, all the success of Brian Epstein, Beatle manager, blah, blah, blah. Brian Epstein had one American group."
That was you guys.
"Ladies and gentlemen, the Circle," you know, and it was like, "Oh my God, that's right." You know,
you never looked at it like that. Yeah.
Something you know, but you didn't quite look at like that. Yeah. So all right. So we did that. Anyway, I'm back at Cape May now, and this is the next week when this show is going to air. And once again, just an out of body experience, sitting in the dining room in Cape May, the whole camp is in there because they all knew, hey, somebody is going to be on, you know, one of our cadets is going to be on this show. And I still remember it was a black and white TV. And I said, "Please, I hope they didn't cut us, you know, because I lose all credibility."
Right.
Anyway, on we came, and I'm watching myself on a black and white TV, and everybody is whooping and hollering, "Hey, wow, there he is. Oh, cool. Well, you know," like that. Yeah. So, wow. And anyway, then I went back to being a, you know, boot camp.
Is that the show? I've seen several clips of Red Rubber Ball. Is that the one where there's all those little red rubber balls around you?
Yeah.
And you're kind of sitting, you're kind of on the right side of the screen. And you're sitting.
Yeah, there's the three of us are on the screen. And right. They had a nice setup. And yeah. And
what always struck me with that clip. Okay. Yeah. All right. Even in that red rubber ball picture that he just put up.
Yeah.
Your hair was very short.
Coast Guard, that was boot camp haircut.
That makes sense. I didn't know until I was researching you recently when we were going to do the interview. I didn't know that you were in the Coast Guard. So that made sense to me.
Yeah.
You had the boot camp haircut. There you go. All right. That answered the question I was always curious about.
Okay, so now during the boot camp experience, and it was a combination of the boot camp experience and then when I was out of boot camp and I was on a buoy tender, very luckily, by the way, in Staten Island. So I was in New York able to, it was a very interesting lifestyle. I mean, it was like something out of a movie. I would be like the mess cook on the on this buoy tender during the day. I would be scrubbing pots and pans, and you know, I was a I was, you know, just a lug, you know, doing this stuff. And at night, I could walk up and walk just around the bend to the Staten Island Ferry, which that's where we were.
Right.
Go into New York to Columbia Studios and record. And that was what was going on then. And I would be in touch with Nat. And he would tell me every once in a while, you know, I'd get a phone call. It says, oh, yeah, the Red Rubber Ball sold 25,000 copies in Atlanta this week, you know, and then another one. Red Rubber Ball sold 25,000 copies in Boston this week. It was like constant, right. It was a constant, you know, movement of Red Rubber Ball. And I was able to get out most weekends. And once again, from mess cook to performing. And we would go and perform. I mean, I still remember, I think one of our early performances was on Long Island. And we alternated with Wilson Pickett. I mean, talk about, oh, my God, we're performing with Wilson Pickett.
That's a different kind of lineup right there. That's
Yeah. That was just amazing.
Do you remember where that was done?
I think there was a beach club in Long Island. Can't tell you where.
It was down in, like, Lido Beach or something like that.
Yeah, it was probably. It was.
There was some clubs down there.
Yeah. Anyway. So now the next really important thing that happened was we find out we are invited to be on the Beatles tour.
Yes.
The whole country. We are going to be one of the opening acts. The my Coast Guard reserve duty, the 6-month reserve duty, I would have missed it.
Oh.
It was a month too long. And so we're trying to figure out that they were actually going to replace me. They were going to have to, you know, they didn't want to turn it down, you know, so they were going to replace me and I was going to just not be there. Out of the blue, I mean, when you talk about luck, and my analogy to what happened was, if you're familiar with Andy Warhol, has this saying of everybody has their 15 minutes of 15 fame.
15 minutes, right.
Okay, my interpretation of that is that we were in the 15 minutes of fame at that moment in time. And when you're in that 15 minutes, everything goes right. It all works. And so now, obviously, what I'm saying is not totally accurate, but you'll understand what I'm saying is. Now, the United States government, recognizing that Don was in Andy Warhol's 15 minutes of fame and needed to have something happen, the United States government, and this part is, I'm kidding around, but this has actually happened. Yeah. The United States government changed the 6-month requirement to 5.
So you made it.
I made it. Wow. I didn't ask. Well, I asked the Coast Guard, but I mean, it was mind-blowingly amazing that that happened.
So that was fate.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was fate. Absolutely.
Yeah. So I got out in time. Yeah, I mean, it was one of those moments. It's like, you know, when I guess when you're meant to do something, it works, you know. So somehow or other, it worked. All right, so now we're on the tour. And, of course, now you're going to ask me, well, tell us about the Beatles or tell us about the tour.
Before I ask that. I definitely want to know that. But before I ask that, I mean, you were also playing with the Ronettes and Barry and the Remains, right?
Yes.
How was it like with them? Tell us about that.
Well, Ronnie was not there, for starters.
She wasn't on that tour, right?
Ronnie was not on the tour. So we didn't get the real voice.
Yeah.
Yeah. I actually got one very quick meeting with Ronnie a couple of years ago in New Jersey at an event. It was put on by a promoter that we've become very friendly with. They called it the East Coast Music Hall of Fame.
Right.
And she was there. So she was not there. It's funny. There is one picture that was sent to me. I think our drummer, Scott Langley, actually found it, and you know, of Tommy Dawes, bandmate Tommy Dawes, playing jump rope on the field with the Ronettes.
Yeah.
So there was some casual interaction. You know, I don't have anything. The Remains were very good guys. Now, they did not have a hit, but they were a big Boston group.
Right.
And they turned out to be really good guys. And the other person on the tour was Bobby Hebb.
Bobby Hebb, right.
Who had the hit record Sonny.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, cool.
And we all got along. It was all quite nice.
So now the question is, tell us about the Beatles on that tour.
All right, so,
what's some good stories there?
Okay, so, all right, I have a few kind of things that I can share that sort of hopefully meaningful events that will give a sense of the experience. So the first thing is we are on the plane now from New York to Chicago, which was the first show.
Right.
Everybody's on it. All the acts, all the managers, all the press, the whole deal. It was a regular big commercial airliner. The Beatles were, they built a wall right in the very back, and that's where the Beatles were. So we're on the plane, and all we see is a wall.
They're behind that wall.
Right. Yeah, and we can't wait. Are we going to meet the Beatles? Are we going to meet them? Oh, God, oh, God, oh, God. And even though we had two hit records at the time, but we're still, you know, we're as big Beatle fans as anybody.
Of course.
So finally, near the end of the flight, the door opens, and there's Paul. So, oh, God. Okay, there's Paul. And we're sitting near the front. So, and you could see Paul was a very jovial kind of guy. And he was shaking hands with people and meeting and very regular.
And just to put it in context for a second, this is 1966, right?
Yes, this is 1966.
So this is their Revolver look, like the Rubber Soul Revolver look, right?
Well, I'll let you describe the look. You know.
Yeah, I mean it's that middle period of the Beatles where they, you know, they weren't wearing all the suits anymore, but they still were growing their hair and everything before Sgt. Pepper.
Well, I'm going to tell you my impression of, but let me continue with where.
Go ahead.
In terms of what they were wearing, that's part of one of my impressions that I'll get to in a little bit.
Sure.
Anyway, so there's Paul. So if Paul finally works his way up to us, we're sitting in the front of the plane. I'm sitting next to bandmate Tommy Dawes and Nat Weiss. Now, Nat knows them through Brian. You know, he knows them quite well. So he introduces us. Don Daneman of the Circle meet Paul McCartney. So I get to shake Paul's hands, and I basically get to say, hey, wow, it's so great to meet you. We love you guys. We're so looking forward to playing. Little nothings, you know. And Tommy gets to say the same thing. And then Paul, he says, well, it's great to meet you guys. We're looking forward to hearing. And he walks back down, disappears behind the wall. And that was the end of that meeting. And Tommy and I spent the rest of the flight analyzing every word that got said, which, you know, how could we have been cooler? You know, I mean, this nothing meeting. And
you just met your heroes.
Yeah, that was it. Anyway, all right. So here we are now, the first show, and this is in Chicago. It's an indoor hockey arena.
Right, where the Blackhawks played.
Yeah. Okay, I couldn't tell you who played there. I just know it was an indoor hockey arena. So the stage is down at one end, and it's open. You know, behind the stage are just seats. Now, nobody was sitting there except the people on the tour that were there, but the audience was out the other way. And all right, so the first thing is we were very concerned, not about how we would play, but how we would be received, because we're opening for the Beatles. All we can think of is they're going to yell, no, boo, Brian.
Yeah.
Not the case.
They loved it.
They love, yes. I mean, big whoops and hollers and cheers. And, you know, we start out the show with sort of a fake beginning of Red Rubber Ball.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then we go into something else. I forgot even how we did it. But we started out, yay, whoa, oh, you know, people went bananas when they heard that. So we were very well received. So that was good. All right. Now I am standing backstage and I'm a little bit stage left at the railing, right overlooking the stage itself. There's nobody in front of me except there's the stage. And the Beatles now come out. Now they're coming out stage right. So I'm still very close, but a little bit away. And it's Subdued Light. And now here is my impression. You said, what were they wearing? They were actually nicely dressed. They were wearing jackets. Now, the light may be giving me a wrong impression, but my impression is that they were velvet kind of jackets and like sort of dark green.
Okay.
Once again, I can't tell you that that's really what it was, but that's what it looked like to me.
Yes.
And it was when they came out, of course, the audience went crazy, pandemonium, and it was royalty emerging. You know, that was the feeling was they come out. All right. So now they're on stage and they're starting to play. I looked over at a woman who happened to be standing next to me and she was just crying.
Wow.
I mean, tears. I mean, that was the emotion of the moment. Tears are rolling down her cheeks. She's crying. The next impression that I want to share is that picture. The Wizard of Oz, and he's backstage behind a little curtain with his own little room there, and he has a big console, control console, with a lot of buttons on it. Mm-hmm. And every button sends a little shockwave to the seats in the audience.
Gives you a little jump. Yeah.
And what I saw as I looked out was I saw little girls responding to the Wizard of Oz, pushing the button.
Pushing the button on the seats.
Jumping out of their seat. Jump, jump. I mean, you know, wherever you look, jump, 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 jump.
That's that, funny.
That was my impression of the first.
They must have had a director, William Castle, involved because he used to do that in the movies, The Tingler and all that stuff at that time.
All I can tell you is if he directed that, that's
he used to do that in the theaters.
That's what was there.
Wow. Hey, let me ask you a question.
Sure.
When you guys did the album, did you think it was going to be a big hit?
When we recorded when we did Red Rubber Ball?
Yeah, do you think it was going to be a big hit or it was just something that came out of left field?
Not a clue.
Wow.
No, we did not have a clue. All we knew was, holy cow, we have this record contract. We're managed by Brian Epstein. You know, we're recording.
Don, while you're on tour with the Beatles, the album is already recorded and out, or is it just?
Oh yeah, no. Red Rubber Ball at this point was a hit. Full fledged hit, and Turn Down Day was kind of on the way up. So we actually had two hit records at the time of the Beatles tour.
Yeah, so everybody kind of knew you from that.
Oh yeah. No, we were known. All right. So now the next thing I can share with you of meaningful is, all right, now we hadn't actually met the whole band. We just had that one little bit with Paul. Mm-hmm. And this was now the third concert, which was Cleveland. And finally, before the show, we got an invitation. Guys, come on back. The boys, they were lovingly referred to as the boys. The boys want to meet you. Mm-hmm. Oh, great. Okay. So we go back, and it's very strange because you go in now, and once again, we're going to meet royalty. But the royalty, when they went in there, they were kind of lounging on the couches. You know, they're just spread out, lounging on the couches. You know, they were very regular.
Just like regular guys. Yeah.
Very regular. Mm-hmm. And so we went through, you know, Don Daneman, meet Ringo Starr, meet Paul McCartney, meet John Lennon. I ended up in front of George and I had the most wonderful conversation with George, who turned out to be very genuine. And when I say genuine, I mean, he started asking me like, well, how did you get here? You know, tell me a little bit about you. Like he was interested.
Yeah. Yeah.
How did you get here? And he even shared, I had to tell you, I'm blown away. It's only a few years ago, we were a bar band in Liverpool, you know. He didn't forget like that.
Right.
We had a wonderful conversation.
Did you manage to maybe speak to John about how he named the band?
The only direct thing that we had with John, and it happened a couple of times, you know, at various times, he would look over us and he said, "Cell guys, have you learned to spell yet?"
That sounds like him.
Yeah, that would be, that would be. And we go, "Yeah, well, no, we haven't learned, you know, we haven't learned." So it was a nice interaction. I mean, there was one night we just played cards with Paul and Ringo. You know, just, you know, tell me a great story about Paul or Ringo. Well, they basically obviously knew that, you know, we were new guys. We didn't have a lot of money and we played for money, but it was quarters, you know, like they were very cognizant of, like, you know, we're just a couple of guys playing cards. And it was basically a nice time. You know, they were just good couple of guys playing cards.
Wow.
The next thing, let's see, I'll share is, now people have asked me, do you have any specific knowledge of, you know, the Christ thing, you know, with John?
Oh, and, yeah, because that happened on that tour.
No,
right?
It did happen. Now, we of course, heard about it, and there were little talks about it, but we never got into.
This is when John Lennon said the Beatles are bigger than Jesus.
Oh, bigger than Jesus. Yeah. We didn't have direct conversations about it. So, but we were certainly aware of it, you know. I do remember John was asked, you know, tell us about, you know, you're putting backwards recordings on your stuff. And John would tell him, no, we don't use backwards recordings on our thing. That's the Circle.
Glad you guys.
Yeah, right. Anyway, so the next, I think, interesting thing on the Beatles tour is in St. Louis. It was like threatening rain. And we were about to go on. And at the last minute, they yelled to us, "Guys, stop." They pull us. "We got to get the Beatles on before it rains."
Oh.
"So you're not going on."
Oh.
Well, now, obviously, that's a bummer, but we certainly understood that. I mean, the Beatles had to go on, you know.
Right.
Okay. Beatles go on, and they do their show, normal show. People went crazy, blah, blah, blah. It's an outdoor stadium. There must have been 50, 60,000 people, whatever. And now the Beatles are done, and it's not raining yet. And they come up to us and says, "Guys, you're going on."
So now you're following the Beatles.
So
that's kind of scary.
I just want to tell you that I can say to you and look you right in the eye here. I'm going to, is this the right here camera? The Beatles opened for us in St. Louis.
Wow.
Hey, I know another guy that I had a conversation with at the State Theater in Easton, believe it or not.
Really?
Who said the same thing, and that's Chris Montez.
Okay.
Okay. And that's absolutely true, though. It wasn't any reverse of the order. He was on tour with them in England, and he was the main act.
Oh, so that's before they got really big.
Yes.
Oh, yeah, sure.
That's true. But they did open for you. You can say
anyway,
that.
Anyway, so I just want to give you my impression of that. Now, so here is big stadium out there, and now the Beatles are done, and we're going out.
Uh-huh.
All right, so I am now watching a very large part of the audience. They're slowly leaving,
of course.
But here's the neat thing about it, though. I'm going to say a third to a half stayed.
Stuck around.
They stuck around.
Wow.
And they really applauded. The cheers were just as enthusiastic as if it were before, you know, like that. So on one hand, it was like bummer. On the other hand, it was actually quite rewarding in that we held, you know, maybe 20,000 people or so, that we held them. They stayed.
Yeah.
And that was pretty cool.
Well, Red Rubber Ball made it to number two, right?
Yeah, it did.
And Turn Down Day, I think, got to 16 or so, right?
Correct. Yes.
So, I mean, you're talking, you know, two top 20 hits. And
yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I have a question, Don. What held you, what or who was it that held on to the number one spot that Red Rubber Ball couldn't get to number one? Do you know?
Very well, I know, because we do it as part of our show.
Who was it?
Paperback Writer.
Hey, yep, the Beatles.
Paperback Writer. And we do it as part of the show. I mean, and what I basically do is I announce, ladies and gentlemen, you know, Red Rubber, I have some interesting news for you. Red Rubber Ball was such a big hit, and it's such an honor to have sung it, you know, but sadly, it only made number two. And you hear this little, oh, you know, the audience does that. And I say, but at least if we had to lose to somebody, it was our friends, the Beatles. When Red Rubber Ball was number two, the following was number one. And then we bang into a pretty good version of Paperback Writer. You know, it's like harmony to start. Paperback, paperback, paperback writer.
Did that tour end at Candlestick?
Yes.
Okay. And tell us a little bit about that show, if you don't mind.
Okay, so yeah, that's the next thing I was going to lead up to. And that is, I still remember, it was kind of a, I guess it's very typical that it's like cold and
many years ago, I went there for a baseball game, a Giants game.
Yeah.
Against the Mets many, many years ago. And yeah. They said no matter how warm it is in San Francisco, it's cold at Candlestick and you have to dress for it.
Yeah, I remember it was cold.
Yeah.
Anyway, the thing that I wanted to share with you about it is now, as we're walking around backstage, and there's George walking around backstage, and he has a camera.
Oh.
And he's walking around, he's taking pictures, and we asked him, you know, why are you taking pictures? You don't think there's enough people taking pictures of this? There's going to be thousands of pictures. Why do you? And he shared with us. He said, well, you know, we're kind of getting tired of doing this. And I'm not sure if we're going to really play anymore. Like
live anymore, right? This
kind of stuff. I just want to have some personal memories. And son of a gun, he would, you know, they never played again. Except
That was the very last show that the Beatles did in America.
Yeah.
And they wouldn't be doing too many more shows after that. In general, they just became a studio band.
Wow. Well, except for the rooftop one.
Abbey Road. Yeah.
Yeah. So, and that was kind of cool. And then the last thing that I will share about the Beatles tour is, and I'm going to start it out by saying, boy, were we stupid. And that is on the last plane ride now from San Francisco to L.A., where they were going to, everybody was getting left off and now you're on your own.
Right.
And everybody, this is where everybody broke down and was taking pictures with the Beatles. And they were very willing to pose and take pictures with everybody. And we decided that we did not want to be looked at as just silly Beatles fans.
Oh, boy.
And so we didn't take pictures with them. And, you know.
Yeah. Well, that's one of those things you kick yourself in the ass.
Really, 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 really stupid. There does exist now. It's been gotten to me. I think once again, our drummer Scott Langley came up with it. There is a picture of. It might have been L.A., but I'm not sure. You know, you see me leaning against the stage. The picture is taken from the ground. And here's the stage. You see me leaning against the stage, looking toward the camera, a little bit of a distance. And George is walking right by.
OK.
So to my knowledge, that's the only picture of any of us with a Beatle. Now, there are pictures of us on stage, you know, and you could see Ringo's drums, Beatles, you know, and in terms of, yes, we were really there, you know, but that's about it. And if anybody happens to have a picture of us with any Beatles, send them because, you know, it would be great to have it.
Let's jump ahead a little bit, Don. I know that you released the Circle released a second album called Neon. In late 66.
Yeah.
And you were also involved in a movie soundtrack, a movie called The Minx.
Yeah.
In 1967. That's something I'm pretty savvy at that era with stuff. I'm actually not familiar with that at all. I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about the Minx.
Well,
why you got involved with that movie.
All right. This was at a point where we were basically breaking up. And the reason we were breaking up is because even though we really got better at things, and if you listen to Neon, there's some really neat.
I have listened to that album. It's very interesting. Yeah,
it is.
Yeah.
But what happened? Basically, this is one of these things you can't totally define. But essentially, you can take the best song, the best singers, the best writers, the best recording studio, the best everything. You can put it together and you can guarantee a very good piece of work, good recording. What you can't guarantee is the magic that takes it from really good to hit.
Yeah.
Red Rubber Bullet, Turn Down Day had it. The other stuff, good as it was, and whatever reason, didn't quite get to major hit. We did have a bunch of charted records, but not that level.
Do you think it was just the changing tastes in music, even in that short period of time?
Combination, yeah,
a little bit.
Combination. You know, one thing that I, in retrospect, I regret is we were very intellectual. You know, things can be simple. We had to really do stuff. I mean, it had to have intricate parts to
right. Think.
And even if it sounds simple, there was an intricacy to it. And the one thing that I'm kind of sorry we didn't at least try was to do a simple three-chord song. Just get out there and have fun. Kind of along the lines of Rascals doing Good Lovin'.
Good Lovin' type thing, yeah.
Something like that. I think that would have benefited us.
I think you were the perfect band for that kind of sound.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, so, but as the, you know, so sales went down and it was like, you know, I think maybe it's time to break up. So we're in the process of kind of breaking up. And a friend of Nat Weiss, his name was Herb Jaffe, was a co-producer of this picture. The original picture was called Squeeze Play.
Okay.
And if you listen to the album, the music of it, and you see the picture, the theme song is Squeeze Play, not Minx. And what happened was it when it was finished, it was thought to be a really lousy picture, and they tried to do anything to get it more marketable, whatever. And so after the fact, they shot some semi-porn scenes.
Okay.
And put them in.
Sex it up a little bit.
Yeah, and changed the name to the Minx.
Wow.
Now, what we have found, though, is that over the course of time, the Minx has become kind of a cult favorite. There's something cult, yeah. You know, there's people have latched onto it and, you know, it's played.
Like I said, I'm very interested. I've always been into that era. OK, yeah. Especially films or music.
Yeah.
And that's one that's eluded me. So I'm definitely going to look for it and check it out.
Yeah. And anyway, and we are actually in the movie.
Okay. Performing.
We are the band, basically. Okay. There are two scenes in the disco. One is in the afternoon where they're just talking, that, you know, whatever's going on. I don't remember even. And we're in the back kind of putting our equipment together and warming up. Okay. And then there's the nighttime disco scene where we're actually playing and they're dancing. And so we're actually in the movie.
Right. No, that's awesome. You know, so how many songs do you have on the soundtrack?
I don't remember. Hmm. But it's a full album.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's a full album. I don't know how many songs it is.
So at this point, you break up after the soundtrack pretty much, or that's the end of it there?
Yeah, we broke up.
But for people that don't know, what's interesting is both you and Tom Dawes had a very interesting career after the Circle writing jingles.
Yes, yes.
And I didn't know that either. And I thought that was just, wow, what a jump to something different. But I it makes sense because you were writing hooks in the Circle. So
yes, yes. And I can actually do you a little performance.
Oh, please do.
Because if our show is long enough, we actually do a commercial bit. In the show,
I'd love you.
And I mean, I'll just sing it live how we do it. It won't be exactly the same. But essentially, we talk about, hey, what'd you do? I mean, you know, in the revival now when we're performing, like, hey, you broke up in 1968 and this is now 2024. Or even a few years ago. Well, what have you done ever since? And I talk about how we both got into commercials, and actually Tommy started it. I'll give him credit. And mm-hmm. I thought, this looks good. I'll do it too. The first commercial we had anything to do with, we had nothing to do with producing it. It was a commercial, but it made us aware of commercials. And almost every rock band did a version of this, and it was called Great Shakes. And I'm going to sing it for you in a second because all it's right. part of the thing. So what we do is I basically say, here is a rough sample of commercials that we had involvement in. Can't say I wrote every one of them, but, you know, we did something that was related to these commercials. Okay. You know, wrote it, recorded it, arranged it, something.
You were involved with it, right.
All right, so here's how this thing goes. Any place can be a soda fountain now with Great Shakes, new Great Shakes. Shake it up with milk and make a real thick shake with Great Shakes, new Great Shakes. Ba 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 ba. 7 Up, 7 Up, 7 Up, Dion Cola. 7 Up, Dion Cola.
I remember that one.
Da 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 da. It's the next best thing to your good cooking. Swanson makes it good. It's the next best thing to your cooking. Swanson makes it good. Da, 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 da. We're going to move our tail for you to make your every wish come true. On Continental Airlines, we really move our tail for you.
That's great. Da, da, da.
Who can you call on for better insurance? Who can you call nationwide? Who can you count on for blanket protection and know that you'll find peace of mind? Nationwide is on your side. Nationwide is on your side.
We know that.
The Hess truck's back and it's better than ever for Christmas this year. The Hess truck's here.
Right.
Da, 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 da. Come on, baby, let's do the brim twist. Oh, come on, baby, let's do the brim twist. How come decaffeinated coffee got great ground flavor like this? That's the brim twist. Da, 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 da. And that's how we do the commercial bit.
That's, wow. That's great. I mean, some of that stuff you still hear, like the Hess truck commercial.
Yeah.
You'll get that every Christmas.
Yeah, they still do that. Anyway, yeah. So just one more little part of it that as long as I did this, I'll finish this up. So the next thing now that I say is, you know, one thing that happens in commercials is a lot of times they actually have musical competitions. And so this music house they ask you, write something, and you write something, and you write something, and the winner gets the gig. And there's a big difference between doing a demo and actually getting the thing on the air. And so we actually, 3 years in a row, I am so proud to say, we actually beat bandmate Tommy Dawes in Coppertone commercials. And we had 3 years in a row. And here's one of them.
Okay.
1, 2, 3, and flash him a dark tan. Flash him a fast tan. Flash him a copper tone tan. Flash him a copper tone tan. Ba da da. So now, and everybody, you know, a little applause, you know.
Yeah.
All right. And now, and this is the whole big punchline now. But ladies and gentlemen, I gotta say, I mean, so yes, we beat Tommy 3 years in a row, but he went on and wrote the one jingle that there's not anybody in here that doesn't know, unless maybe you were just born. The biggest, you know, stupidest little thing, but everybody knows it. Tommy, he's looking down, laughing at us from Rock and Roll Heaven. Now, you ready, guys? 1, 2, 3. Plop, plop, fizz, fizz. Oh, what a relief it is. Plop, plop, fizz, fizz. Oh, what a relief it is. Plop.
We all know that one.
And that's the commercial. That's our commercial.
No, I mean, look, those commercials are as much a part of popular culture as the music is, the regular music, you know?
Yeah.
It's amazing. Wow. So, Okay, now many years go by and you're doing jingles, and but something happens in 2014 where you start coming back. And there's a gentleman named Pat McLaughlin of an Ohio band called The Gas Pump that was pretty instrumental in getting you back together. Is that correct?
Yes. All right. So that story is as follows. It was actually 2016.
Okay, 2016.
2016. The Gas Pump Jockeys were a band in Columbus, Ohio, and Pat was the leader of the band. And Mike Loskamp, our keyboard player, who took over for Earl Pickens in fall of 1966. So he was there, you know.
Right.
Yeah, he was really there. And Pat keeps on, and Pat is a salesman, besides being a really nice guy. He's a real salesman. And he says, you know, Mike, you were a Circle. Why can't we revive the Circle? And a booking agent friend of his said, why don't you get one of the other original guys? And yeah, you can do that. And as many of your listeners know, all of the bands of that era, there's almost nobody that's the whole original band. You know, sometimes there's nobody original. They just own the name.
Right.
Or there's one or two, maybe, you know, originals. I am proud to say that I am an original founding member of the Circle, and I announce it, and I'm very proud to still be able to do it. So they went out looking, and this is really funny to me. Pat got all sorts of programs to find people. How do you find people? He couldn't find me. Mm. And the really funny part of it is that I have gotten fan mail from as far away as Poland and Russia to my house.
Hmm.
Now, these people found me. Anyway, Pat.
Yeah, that happened.
Anyway, finally, there was a connection and, you know, Pat found me. So we talked and, you know, my wife gave me permission. Ha ha. Like, you want to try going back out, you know. So they flew me to Columbus. I live in Delaware, and they flew me to Columbus. And it was really very simpatico. Pat and his wife, Sandy, greeted me at the, you know, they put me up in a hotel. Now, when I'm there a lot and I stay at their house, you know, but at that time, hotel. Okay. We had coffee in the lobby, and they seemed like really nice people, and we chatted. They brought me to the home of Don White, lead guitarist, who has a studio set up in his basement, and that's where the band rehearses. And this was also funny to me because when they brought me in, they really treated me like a rock star. I mean, this was like a huge deal. Don mm-hmm. Daneman is coming to our house, you know, da da da. And the band and wives were kind of lined up around the front door with Loskamp standing in the back, Mike Loskamp. And so I go through quick, hello, shake hands, da da da. And there's Loskamp. And they were worried about what is he going to do when he meets Mike. Well, I gave him a hug. You know, it was great to see Mike. You know, he's a wonderful, you know, he's a great keyboard player. He sings great. Anyway, so we had pizza, and then we went downstairs and we started playing. And of course, they knew Red Rubber Ball and Turn Down Day. That was easy. We did it. Was fine. And we're talking about other things to play. And I thought, well, you know, why don't we try Feeling Groovy, the song that we had a chance to do that we didn't?
Right.
Also part of the show, you know, like Paul Simon offered the song and we didn't do it, you know. So I started playing it and they immediately picked up on it and they just, you know, and it just worked. They picked up the harmony. They, you know, so, and it's very similar to the way we actually perform it now. It was almost immediate. And I still remember drummer Scott Langley. He put his head down on the drums after we did this. And because everyone agreed, wow, that really sounds like the Circle. You know, it sounds like what the Circle would do. And he said, if we go no further, I'm a happy guy. That was Scott's feeling. And so we started this and Pat set up a video to do a demo. I mixed it myself. I can mix it in my studio. So I took the tracks and I was able to mix it. And it wasn't until the following year, actually, in 2017, when we got our first gig.
Right.
And it was in Lakewood, New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
And we only got the gig because I think something happened. It was the Love and Spoonful that for some reason had to cancel.
They dropped out. Yeah.
Yeah. And promoter Joe Mirioni, who has become also a really good friend of the band, he was suggested by our agent, hey, why don't you try the Circle? So we went on, and it was, and we didn't know how it was going to be, you know. So we did our show. It was a short show. They only gave us, I think, 15 minutes. We opened the show. When we finished Red Rubber Ball, we got a standing ovation. And so we figured, oh, I guess we can do this. And so since then, we have played. Now, we are not ever like on the road, as in we're gone for a month at a time or 2 months. We don't want to do that.
Right.
But we are sporadically booked around the country at various locations. And we do well whenever we play. We've done well. And we've played with many of the big 60s groups of the time.
That's great.
Yeah. And we're about to go on the Flower Power cruise. When this is aired, this will be passed. But as we're doing the interview, in a couple of days, I'm about to fly to Puerto Rico and get on this ship, meet the band, and we're playing on the Flower Power cruise. And the thing that's very cool about it is, because we've done it before, is that this is, everybody on the cruise is there for the music. So, I mean, you have the crew, and that's obviously, they're there to
do.
But everybody else, there's either the talent or management or people related to the talent, and then the passengers. And
who else is playing with you, Don?
Wait a minute. Actually,
what other acts?
Oh, it was a lot. Now, I had a list. Let me see if it's still here, because I don't remember. Here we go. Yeah, I got it. Okay. Temptations, Hermans, The Association, wow. Cowsills, Zombies, Guess Who, Mark Lindsay of Paul Revere and the Raiders, Peter Asher.
Wow.
A lot of cover bands that are really good. The cover bands are really good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's interesting with the Guess Who, because Randy Bachman just played as the BTO up here in Long Island at Westbury.
Oh yeah.
Okay. Recently. They said it was great. He did like about a quarter of the songs were Guess Who songs that they did.
Yeah. Okay. Cool. Anyway, so we're really looking forward to that. And plus we've done several Beatle Fests, and we have one coming up also. It's called Abbey Road on the River. I think it's at the end of May coming up.
Okay.
It's outside of Louisville, Kentucky. I think it's Jeffersonville, Indiana is the actual town. And that was a fun thing. We did that, I think, a year or two ago. We're doing that again. So, and we have a good time. We have a good time. Yeah.
And as you know, as you're doing these tours coming up, you're also promoting your new album called Revival.
Yes.
And
yes.
It comes out March 22nd. By the time this show is up, it'll be out. You can get it on Amazon and all the places that sell stuff online. They're on Big Star Records, which is a great label. Everybody should support the bands on that label.
Yeah.
There's also two singles already have been, you know, you have two little videos online I saw related to it.
Yeah.
We Thought We Could Fly.
Right.
And a track called Dance With Me Tonight. I checked them out. They're fantastic. Great little pop songs.
Well, let me tell you about, I'll give a little shout out to the album. So we'll start out with We Thought We Could Fly. That one to me is a really major emotional trip. And essentially what happened is Daniel Costin, a photographer and very good friend of the band, who is a very musically knowledgeable guy and has connections, excuse me. He sent me a song out of the blue. He just sent it to me. This is a year or two ago. Sent me a song. He said, no, listen to this. I listened to it. It was a pleasant song. It had a definitely 60s feel. There was Beatles influence and Beach Boy influence, which was, they were our gods, the Beatles and Beach Boys. And then I asked him, Daniel, why am I listening to this? He says, okay, now I can tell you. This song was recorded in 2002 by a fella who was a really, Andrew Sandoval. It was recorded by Andrew Sandoval, a very good friend of your deceased bandmate, Tommy Dawes.
Mm.
And Tommy sang all the background vocals on this song.
So he's on it.
Now this is not We Thought We Could Fly. So here's what happened was, I had this feeling to do, gee, I wonder if I could do something like Free as a Bird, Beatles, how they pulled, you know?
Yeah.
But I actually went further. I got permission and I got the tracks and I got Tommy's vocals, pulled them off, and I actually manipulated them such that I could write a new song.
Oh.
And, you know, I started out with his vocals and I set them up. Okay, here's the verse. All right, now I'm going to repeat it because it's going to be the verse again, and then I'm going to do. And what I did is I wrote a song that was a tribute to the relationship. This was a fellow circle, mm-hmm. Rondell circle, that, you know, I sang Red Rubber Ball with. You know, I start out Red Rubber Ball. He joins me. There's the harmony. That was the circle sound. I'm going to get to sing with Tommy one more time. Now, of course, it's not going to sound anything like Red Rubber Ball. And it wasn't supposed to, because it's an emotional tribute. But I was able to share kind of events, some major events in the life of it, including the last verse where in 2007, before he died, we actually had talked about, we're both retired, hey, let's revive the band. And then he went and died on me. Yeah. So, you know, and the lyrics, you said, you want to start a band, but you left me for rock and roll heaven.
Right.
That's part of the lyric. And that's
I get it. Yeah.
And as I wrote it and worked on it, I found myself choking up, tearing up. Like, wow. But it gave me a chance to sing with Tommy Dawes one last time. That to me was a major deal. So, and the video, I mean, I did the video and we took zillions of pictures of Tommy and we floated them around, you know.
Yeah, I saw it. Yeah.
It was kind of cool. So anyway, that's We Thought We Could Fly. Excuse me. We're recording. You can edit, right? I'm going to call. Okay. Next is Dance With Me Tonight. Now, Dance With Me Tonight is simply a fun song. And it was something that we heard, and Pat, bandmate Pat McLaughlin, he latched onto. He says, you know, I would love to do this song. And when we've done it in person, whenever we do it in person, it's an up thing, and people clap, and you know, it gets a really good reaction. And there's a couple of neat things about it. One is, it gave Pat a chance to sing a lead, and he does a really nice job on it. And the other thing is, he actually went and got our second producer, who is still active, Charlie Colello. I don't know if you know who Charlie Colello is?
The name rings a bell.
All right. Charlie Colello is actually, he performed with the Four Seasons, and he's an arranger on lots of stuff. And I can't even name them all, but he definitely did a lot of
work. He worked with the Four Seasons, though, right?
Oh, yeah. Big.
That's how I know the name.
Yeah. Big work with the Four Seasons, and mm-hmm. but a lot of stuff. And right. I won't name it because I may get some things wrong, but people would know things that he did. And Pat sent him the thing and got him to add brass and help with the mix on the thing. So it was fun that Charlie Colello, our second producer in 1967, actually did some work on this record. So there's this connection.
It's like a full circle kind of thing.
It's kind of full circle. Very cool.
Yeah.
So that's that. And there is one more single that will be released. And that's We Were There. And that one basically honors the fact that, holy cow, we were a band that had some hit records at a major time when music was changing, We were with the Beatles. We were managed by Brian Epstein. Oh my God. We did. We were there.
Yeah.
And that's kind of a song that, you know, talks about that. That was awesome. The next single that comes out.
There's also some new versions of Red Rubber Ball and Turn Down Way, right?
Turn Down Day.
Turn Down Day.
Yeah, that was actually the way this thing started. Actually, was this is Daniel Costin, photographer friend. He came up to us and he said, "You know, you guys should do an album, and it should be the next. Like, what would the band maybe have done had you not broken up and keep going?" And we all thought, nah. And he was so insistent on it. So we thought, all right, let's see, what should we do? So we figured, all right, we're going to re-record Red Rubber Ball and Turn Down Day, and we're going to record them. We want to keep them close to the original, but it's just a modern New Day recording.
Right.
And that's what we did. And frankly, you don't realize it's not hard to play the songs, but what's really hard is to get them to sound close to the original, because every little sound makes a difference.
Yeah.
And I know that we recorded it together in Columbus at a recording studio, and then they sent me the tracks and I was not satisfied with it. And I actually did some additional work, even just the sound of the lead guitar. Well, when we did it, you know, plugged into an amp, played it, and I thought, okay, that's fine. And when I listened to the recording, I thought, gee, it doesn't sound like the original. And I went back and forth between all sorts of settings and guitars and everything. And finally, I got close, you know. And
it is very close.
Yeah. So there's a lot of work goes into that. Same thing with Turn Down Day.
Yeah.
So we did that. And then we did Feeling Groovy, which is the song we could have done but didn't.
Right.
And this is what it would have sounded like. And people seem to like that. I mean, that it's a great sound. It came out really well. And then we did The Visit, which is a song from the Neon album that Mike sings lead on, Mike Loskamp. Mm-hmm. And it was the B-side, but even now it kind of gets some recognition and gets streamed. It gets some airplay.
Yeah.
So that was the first thing we did. And then it was like, you know, Daniel kept on bugging us. Come on, guys, you got to keep going. You got to keep going. And we did. So we did.
So are there any chance of you playing New York City soon?
We played, I'm thinking it's a year or two ago. We played Lakewood, New Jersey, Tarrytown.
Tarrytown's a good venue.
And Long Island. I don't remember what town it was.
Did you do the Westbury Music?
We have not played Westbury, but we played Long Island.
Hmm.
And so, yeah, you know, next time Joe Mirione does one of those three things, I'm sure we'll be out there. And
yeah, and I'll definitely attend.
And if we're there, you come up and say hi. We shake
hands. I will. Yeah. And actually, I make my way through Delaware every so often too. So maybe have a cup of coffee or something.
Absolutely. Well, if you're coming through,
mm-hmm.
Email me.
Okay.
And love. Yeah, absolutely. You come over. You'll have a cup of
coffee. Oh, wow. Yeah, nice. Exactly.
And of course, you know, when you are in New York City, Rob is a bartender. There's a stool waiting for you, whatever.
Oh, terrific. And, terrific.
Right? He works down in the East Village.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, all right, Don Daneman, thank you for coming on. Thank you for such an informative, exciting interview.
And, well, thank you. Thank you for having me. I hope it works.
Great stories, man.
The stories were great. And I'm just glad that you guys are back on the scene. It's a good album, Revival by The Circle, out on Big Stir, March 22nd. By the time this is up, you can get it. And, you know, we're going to keep in touch. And if you got anything, you know, to promote or whatever, please let us know. We'll get it out there for people.
Absolutely. We'll do that. Yeah, lovely to meet you guys.
Thank you. And what do we say at the end of every show, Rob?
We don't get drunk.
We get lumped up.
See you next time.
Take care.
Getting lumped up with Rocker Mike and Rob Rossi. I'm getting lumped up with Rocker Mike and Rob Rossi. Well, I'm lumped up, but I'm okay. It's gonna get just getting loved up with Rocker Mike and Rob Ross. Getting loved up with Rocker Mike and Rob Ross.